Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Joining us this evening is Alan Lakovetsky, a highly renowned Winnipeg contemporary ceramicist whose innovative high-fire techniques and process are internationally inspired. His early study at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, the University of North Dakota, and his mentorship with master potters in Canada, the UK, Australia, and Asia have contributed to his many years of producing exquisite work shown in exhibitions around the globe. Alan's studio is located outside Winnipeg, surrounded by brilliant natural landscapes of the prairies near Okamic Marsh that he embraces in his pottery. Alan has taught ceramics in numerous universities, done workshops, and exhibited in Canada, US, France, Japan, China, Korea, and Australia. His ceramics are in many public and private collections worldwide. He has also been inducted into the International Ceramic Artists Association based in China. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us what first inspired you to become a potter?
Well, that goes back a long, long way, actually. My father was in the furnace business, so I was around furnaces a lot. And I remember as a kid watching our furnace downstairs and looking through this little mica window and seeing the fire starting up. And that was quite exciting for me. But not only that, beside the furnace, he had an old handmade crock that he made wine in because it kept the wine warm. But I remember the nice smell that it gave off. And then also caressing my hand over the handle, and my fingers fell into the thumb marks that the potter had left when they attached the handle, and realized, ooh, this thing is handmade. Somebody was actually there and left that message of that thumbprint. And I think that might have been one of the sparks that lit my fire that eventually came me later in life.
So who are some of your most important mentors during your artistic development and over the course of your career?
I started out in British Columbia on one of the Gulf Islands, and I was interested in Zen philosophy, and that kind of led me to the Japanese tea ceremony and looking at these tea bowls that they used for the ceremony and finding out there was much more to them than just a bowl that you drink tea out of. And that kind of led me to looking at pottery in general and who was out there and where I can find information. I picked a book from the library, and it was called A Potter's Book by Bernard Leet. And it was the perfect book to pick because he expounded on the philosophy behind pottery, and particularly Korean, Chinese, and Japanese pottery. And that really was one of the things that ignited my fire as well. And I went on to study with one of his apprentices, John Reeve, at Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. And that really got me started.
Some of the other ones along the way? You were in Australia and you did some other work there and teaching. Who else was influential at that time?
Well, I did come back to Winnipeg after living in BC and came across an exhibition by Robert Archambault at the Thomas Galleries and thought, this work is the kind of work that I'm very interested in, the kind of work that I want to make. So I did come back and studied with Robert for 2 years at the University of Manitoba. That was before I actually went to Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. So that was pretty major as well, and it continues to be major because I'm constantly in contact with Robert. So he's been one of my more important mentors. But aside from that, after Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, I went to Australia, and I worked with Peter Rushforth, who is one of the original potters, grandfathers of pottery in Australia, and also Gwyn Hanson-Piggott, who was also very prominent both there and in Europe. She was an apprentice with Bernard Leach, Lucy Rhee, and Hans Koper. So they all had a different kind of influence on me, and I think it was really important to have that kind of mentorship with artists who were kind of operating at a high level internationally. So I feel very fortunate to have had contact with these people.
So can you describe a particular piece or series for us that will give us an idea of the clay materials you prefer to use and the process for creating your pottery?
Early on, way back when I was a kid, I was always Very interested in fossils, and they kind of blew me over, the idea that these critters have left this message really is hundreds of millions of years old. And, you know, the rocks, the age of the rocks and the geological processes that these things have gone through really have cemented my interest in material. Natural material. So looking at clay is hundreds of millions of years old. And I just think all these particles, where did they come from? Where were they originally? And what journey have they been on over all this time to get to my hands? And if they could tell a story, they would be some pretty amazing stories. So I respond to clay because I feel that it's a very sacred material. It's a living material. It's so impressionable. You just lightly touch it and you leave your fingerprint in it. And you can see in ancient pottery, the potter did exactly that. You know, as they picked the pot up, they left their fingerprint in it. And it's kind of a message that they've left. And I somehow find that quite fascinating.
You also, in your practice, use a traditional treadle wheel when you're making your pottery, and it's part of your process. What is it about that that you prefer?
Well, I use a combination of foot-powered wheels. One is a treadle wheel, and it's a wheel that used to be used by one of the grandfathers of pottery in the USA, Warren McKenzie. So I have it here in my studio, and I consider it quite an honor to have it and to work on the wheel that he spent many years working on. And I have another kick wheel. It's a different type of wheel where you have a heavy flywheel and you have to get it moving, and then it has its own momentum. You don't have to constantly kick it like the treadle wheel. But it's significant for several reasons, because I like to use my own energy to create my work. Also, compared to an electric wheel, they don't have the motor noise that I don't like. It's not a creative sound for me. I like to listen to the wind in the trees and the birds outside, so I can't do that if I have a motor constantly making that noise. But this other kick wheel is significant for me because it was one of the wheels I learned on when I first went to the University of Manitoba. And they, a few years ago, decided to sell them because I guess they take up too much space. And I was able to buy one. So I have one of the original wheels that I learned on in my studio. And it feels really nice to have it there.
That's great. And is it important that your works are functional as well as aesthetically pleasing?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the functionality, the concept behind it is that it serves an everyday purpose for everyday people. It's not only for other potters or other artists. I get the response from people all the time that, you know, I just love your work, particularly mugs. I use your mug, your coffee mug, every morning when I get up, and I just love it. And I realized one time that, you know, I have hundreds and hundreds of those out there, and it's fantastic that people, hundreds of people, thousands of people perhaps, are sitting there every morning at an important time of their day, just waking up with my mug, and it's quite an intimate thing because they put that mug to their lips. I just love the fact that I'm able to provide that opportunity for them. It's a form of communication I find really important for me. It gives my work a real sense of purpose that I respond to.
Your works are in a number of collections around the globe where their functionality is experienced and benefited by a number of people. How did your travels contribute to the main ideas and techniques you learned, and how did they contribute to your artistic development?
I'd like to have cultural shock, if you like, influence me in a way. It's a funny thing to say, but when I go to different cultures, and most of them, of course, are much older than the Western Canadian American culture, usually the places I go to have many, many years, centuries of ceramic history, and it's very interesting to be in that environment to see the areas where traditional historical pots have been made for hundreds and hundreds of years, and also witness the techniques that the potters and artists are using still today. It has an influence in some way. I don't think about it too much. I allow the whatever influence it does have to go through a natural filtering process. How it comes out, I don't really pay much attention to, actually, but I know it's there. And the more traveling I do and the more work I do in other areas of the world seems to give me a sense of depth and more confidence in my work. So there's a point where the work just starts to make itself. And I think that's from all the different influences I've had from many parts of the world.
So with the cultural exchange of ideas and the many influences from around the world, what do you feel are the advantages of living in Winnipeg and having your studio in a rural environment in the Canadian art scene?
I've always been interested in the rural environment. Even as a kid, I lived in West Gildon, in the most northern part of Winnipeg, when there was nothing past my street, basically. It was all country, and now it's Garden City and the maples and all that. But I used to take my bicycle out to the prairies and just somehow responded to nature and being outside the city. But being from Winnipeg, I think it's a wonderful city, a quiet, sort of out-of-the-way place. It happens to be the center of North America. I don't know if spiritually that has any effect on people, but I think it's a relatively quiet place. The politics here are not dramatic in any way. I think it's very safe. It's a good community to live in. And particularly, I'm very proud to be Canadian. The more I travel around, the more I realize that Canada is one of the very best countries in the world. And all the people, international people that I'm in touch with, think the same. They have an opinion that compared to most places that they've been or where they're from, Canada seems to be one of the more stable countries. So I tend to agree with them and feel very fortunate that I'm from here.
You've also researched many aspects of designing and creating ceramic works and shared your knowledge and findings with students as a professor and teacher in art schools. What do you focus on, and what is your main advice for students interested in pursuing a career as a potter?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, as you gain more experience, I think you have much more to teach the students. And I think it's more than just teaching a curriculum. I think one of the things that I have to contribute most to students is the mentorship. You want to be able to impart information to students that will take them past the school. There's a life outside of school, and I feel it's important to give students at least a glimpse of what it's like to be out there and how to survive. That's the big thing. If you're standing in front of a class teaching and you feel that the majority of them won't survive, it doesn't feel very good. So trying to create an atmosphere where students are not only learning about what you're trying to teach them in terms of a curriculum, it's important to provide them with that kind of information and to think about what's next. It's exciting for me to be in that environment where young people are enthusiastic. They want to learn, and they're excited about what they're learning. I feel that it's a privilege and an honor to be there, and I know that they sacrifice a lot to be there, and they pay a lot. So it's not easy, especially nowadays, to be a student. And important for me to feel that I'm giving them as much as I possibly can.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on our show. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you for having me. Always interesting for me to talk about my work and my career. It sort of gives me sort of an opportunity to take another sort of look at myself from another direction. So I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
That was contemporary ceramicist Alan Lakovetsky speaking with us from his studio near Oak Hammock Marsh in Manitoba. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest guest this evening is Andrew Keir, Chief Curator at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, here to speak with us about one of the many exhibits he has curated, Ways of Seeming, Recent Acquisitions of Contemporary Art, that opened on July 14th and runs until November 4th. This exhibition brings together key contemporary works from the gallery's collection by photographers, painters, sculptors, and craft artists. Andrew has a Master's of Arts in Canadian Art History from Carleton University and Philosophy from the University of Toronto, as well as a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design. Andrew joined the WAG in 2008 and also teaches art history at the University of Winnipeg. Andrew is speaking with us today about curating this engaging exhibition, Ways of Seeming. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Susan. Thanks.
In July, when the Winnipeg Art Gallery opened this exhibit, Ways of Seeming, Recent Acquisitions of Contemporary Art, you introduced the exhibit stating, Ways of Seeming consists of a very diverse array of objects, materials, and techniques, and all the artists have widely different interests and intentions. Nonetheless, at its heart, the exhibition deals with a single and very old quandary in the history of visual art, namely, the illusionary potential of art itself, the artist's ability to represent something as something else. What do you hope we will experience, feel, and sense as we walk through this exhibition?
Well, I think, like I said and made in that statement, the idea is that artists have been fooling us, basically, for the past couple millennia, if not more. And that is to say, they present us with scenes, with objects that are two things at once. In many cases, they are objects that are just what they are. They're the material that they're made of, the paint on the canvas or the plaster or the marble. And they also, at the same time, simultaneously, give us something to see into. They're presenting us with an illusion of something. Painting does this, of course. It's paint on canvas. At the same time, at least in representational painting, it gives us a scene of something. And that's the very basic starting point. And it was one of the reasons that I think people like Plato and philosophers like that were concerned with the arts, because it's of its capacity to deceive. And artists these days, at least the artists in the exhibition, are come at that whole very old understanding of art as being something and also representing something else in a wide variety of ways. And so my hope is that when people walk through the show, they'll just simply be exposed to that diversity of what it means to be seeming, to be an appearance, and raise questions about what a thing actually is versus what it appears to be.
Is there meant to be a dialogue between the artists that you've chosen and their work?
I don't think there's so much a dialogue, but they have definitely come at the whole issue of seeming in different angles. We have work by, for example, Casey Adams, a local contemporary Indigenous artist, and she has created a series of photographs called the Hybrid Cyborg series, in which she has photographed a selection of her colleagues and friends and presented them in a way that almost makes them look like almost robotic. And each of these people are wearing shirts that say things like, I'm on Indian time, or I can't remember all of them, but they're basically racist slurs. And they are meant to destabilize. We look at this photograph of somebody, they're wearing this T-shirt that bears a kind of stereotypical identifier, and then you read the label and you realize these are actually photographs of their portraits of actual people and the actual, professionals. There's filmmakers, there's curators, there's artists. So that's one way, especially playing with kind of some of the social and political implications of seeming that we can see. Other artists are playing with just the purely visual. So there's a series of well, I don't know what to call them. They're photographs, I guess, by the artist Paul Butler. But they're photographs of collages that he made. So he made these drawings that he wasn't very happy with. He then collaged over them using different colored tape. And then he would photograph that collage element. And then on top of that collage element, he would sometimes add additional pieces of collage tape, a different sort of pastiche elements. So what you're getting is this visual play between the actual tape, the actual material, and a representation of it in the photograph. So that's another example of sort of the ways artists are sort of playing with our intentions. There's a third one, Keith Behrens, an artist who has created some beautiful and caustic paintings, that is, paintings with using hot wax. And he is, they're basically, the paintings are in response to a kind of landscape, a kind of environment, but rather than traditional landscape, they're very much a kind of play on or a kind of direct reaction to the landscape using the language of abstraction. So there's this kind of, they seem to be abstract paintings, but they have this direct tie-in with landscape. I could go on and on, but that's sort of the basic idea.
Being such an accomplished curator with many exhibitions to your credit, can you tell us about the process involved in the preparation of an exhibition such as this? And do you visit their studios? What do you look for?
It can vary. It depends, working in an institution at Root, it depends on the kind of space that's available. I often look at what we've exhibited recently or over the past 5 years, and more importantly, what we haven't exhibited, and try to think of ways to bring more of the collection out on view. I mean, that's something that people should be aware of. When you visit the Winnipeg Art Gallery, you're really only witnessing 2 or 3% of the WAG's total collection on view at any given time. So, and we have such a rich collection, being able to delve into that and bring out works that haven't been shown for some time was part of that. And all of these pieces, although they're all recent, they were acquired between, I think, roughly 2008 and 2016. None of them, to my knowledge, have really been shown, at least in a very extensive way. So it was an opportunity to show some really great contemporary art that hasn't been seen. Now, and we try to vary the shows that are shown in the various spaces. So prior to this show, there was a show on sort of botanical art. We've had numerous Inuit shows in the gallery that this show is currently in. This was an opportunity to just show really contemporary, diverse array of contemporary objects that haven't been, again, as I said, haven't been shown recently.
Do you recall a particular exhibit that was particularly exciting for you and that you had a chance to really explore your interests and passions for research?
I've had so many opportunities like that. I was really lucky to, early on in my career here in Winnipeg, around 2011, 2012, 2010, something like that, put together a William Karelic show, an important Canadian artist from the 1960s and 70s, and that toured across Canada. That was a great opportunity. One of my favorite shows I've also done is an exhibition on German Expressionist printmaking that I did about 5 or 6 years ago. The one that I'm really excited about is the one actually I'm working on now, which will open in late September. And it looks at painting and photography in the 1980s. And the reason it's so interesting, apart from the fact that the 80s have been undergoing something of a resurgence in the zeitgeist for the past, 5 to 7 years, is just that, you know, when you think of the 80s, I think you think of music videos and video in general, new technology. And so the question of why traditional media like painting, oil painting, and still photography persist in that decade, despite the rapid turn to video imagery that you see in popular culture in general, but also in the art world, was an interesting question for me. So that's led to research that has been quite interesting. And again, it's also a show that's going to bring a lot of stuff, a lot of art, out of the vault that we have not seen in some time. This art is all done in the 1980s, and some of it, much of it, in fact, has not been shown, at least in Winnipeg, since the 1990s. So it's a lot of big painting with lots of bright neon colors. But actually, there's this kind of resonance in the 80s. It's also the decade where you see art addressing social issues in a very hard-nosed way, I think, in a very distinct way that I think and issues around gender also, especially with the AIDS epidemic, that artists turn very social and very political, that I think is actually quite resonant nowadays. So I think the 80s, while it's, I guess, technically a historical show, will also have a very contemporary resonance.
Who are some of the artists that you particularly brought in?
Yeah, the I should have mentioned that, of course, the show is, it's all Canadian artists, And there's a good representation of artists who either are from Winnipeg, Manitoba, or at least once lived here. There's Paul Butler. There is Lisa Klapstock, who's a Toronto-based photographer. There's Keith Behrens, a painter from here in Winnipeg. There's Cal Lane, who is, I'm not sure where she's based. She was based on the Maritimes. There is Casey Adams, who I mentioned before. There's Edith Hanna. There's Dominique Ray, a wonderful local, well, she has national presence, but a local photographer. There is Allison Norland's amazing Victoria Bridge. It's this metal sculpture of this historic bridge in Saskatoon. There are a number of other artists, but that's sort of, in a nutshell, the exhibition.
Was there a particular reason you chose that collection of them?
I wanted to focus on contemporary art. Again, this look at especially art that we've acquired recently that has not been exhibited. So, but I didn't want to just, you know, put together a show of, and call it, hey, here's a lot of stuff we haven't exhibited recently. So, right. You know, there was some curating involved there. There were certainly other works that we acquired that didn't quite fit the theme of the exhibition. And it was just more taking some time and looking, going through the vault, looking at these works, trying to figure out what tied them together, what made them very different. And this whole rubric around theming, appearance, reality, just seemed to be something that everything, that all the works sort of could speak to. They're not all speaking to it in the same way or have the same concerns. But that actually makes for quite a rich display.
Well, thank you very much for being on our show. We appreciate you taking the time to share the informative and insightful perspective from a curator's point of view. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Great to join you. Thank you, Susan.
That was Andrew Keir, Chief Curator at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, speaking with us about the exhibition Ways of Seeming, recent acquisitions of contemporary art at the Winnipeg Art Gallery until November 4th, 2018. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.